Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
Let's do it later.
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy?
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to It Never Rains on this podcast. I'm Hithloday. I'm the managing editor for Addicted to Quack. It's a website. Joining me this week is one of the great ATQ writers, Adam Holland. How you doing?
I'm doing well. I'm glad the weather finally cooperated enough for us to get some baseball underway.
Yeah, the scorekeeper's been keeping up some being funny. In the series against Oregon State, the scorekeeper has indicated the weather has been don't see any on then followed by just peachy and rain and bunnies. I'm not really sure what any of that means. But the games were all ultimately played. Low scoring affairs, most of them, at least until the final game, which got, you know, real ugly. I don't know. Just overall thoughts about the series.
Really, I think there's a lot to be happy about. I know it's not easy to say that after you have a 12-2 loss, but you're looking at that and you tell yourself, "Well, this is a team that, you know, was on a hot streak. So, you know, we won 10 in a row, and to go into the series and still get a win." The way they did defensively like that with the pitching was a big step up, especially when it's against somebody like Oregon State. And then if you're talking about the game on Saturday, that was still a close game. So that was kind of like you're battling a top-tier team like that, tooth and nail. Now, the Sunday game, again, you know, that's sometimes going to happen. You'd rather it happen versus like a juggernaut squad like Oregon State rather than, you know, against some kind of like middle of the pack where you're like, what the heck was that? Why would we lose like that to them? But really, I think it was a very good series overall. I really liked Oregon's pitching, and it tells you something when, you know, through a couple games, Oregon State's never even able to, you know, reach like five runs, and especially the shutout. You know, to shut out a team with the ability of Oregon State, I think is a huge statement for Oregon. So despite the, you know, the tough one on Sunday, I was very encouraged by what I saw from them. And I don't think that the win streak was just kind of a fluke. I think this team really is finding its stride.
Yeah, I had pretty much the opposite take, to tell you the truth. I thought this was I thought this sucked pretty bad. I guess I'll put it this way. I thought it was a really sort of baffling series because first of all, let's say, Jay Stoffel's performance in the first game, shutting out Oregon State, was super impressive. That truly was an excellent, top-notch pitching performance. And it was a thriller of a game. If the entire series was just that game, I would have gone home with a big smile on my face. And hell, even if Oregon had lost that game, you know, even if it had, you know, it was a super tight game and Oregon State wound up winning it 1-0, I still would have been pretty happy. Given the nature of that game, and I would have agreed with the way that you described, that game. Even if it had had a different outcome. Honestly, having watched this team, for this season, the way that I would describe it, the Oregon baseball team in the year 2023 would be that, like, the bats are on fire. I mean, just it's an incredible, a batting team. That performance in Arizona where they go down 10-0 and then bat their way out of it, it's sort of an unforgettable performance. And in baseball, just the way that the game is structured, where defense can never get you any points and can never put your offense in a position to score, makes offense the stat of primacy. If you have an amazing batting team, you are never out of a game, and that game demonstrated it. And so even though it was sort of like depressing in a sense how like low scoring this series was, where like Oregon scores exactly 6 runs, 2 in every game, I sort of like at all points I was like, at any point Oregon could break this open. Now, it never happened, but the fact that the fact that Oregon has that capacity meant that like I was watching every single pitch in every one of these games and thinking like, they can break any one of these, games. It never happened, Mm-hmm. But here's the other thing about the Oregon baseball team in the year of 2023 is that like with kind of the exception of Jace Stovall's performance in game one against Oregon State, which kind of like makes this kind of a crazy thing to say, Oregon's pitching sucks. Like, it's terrible. Like, Oregon has multiple pitchers with ERAs over 5, which, I mean, it's like Oregon does not have a good bullpen. What they have is an enormous bullpen. And Coach Woz is like willing to pull pitchers at the drop of a hat. I do like seeing, if there's one thing that I am like enthusiastic about, it's like, pull the guy. Although even then, in the first inning of the third game, I thought that the pitcher should have been pulled because Lee Uhlman like walks the first batter and winds up walking somebody else, gives him a grand slam in the first inning. It's just ridiculous. Pull him, man. Like, if you've lost control of your pitch, you are not getting it back. I don't understand why baseball managers have a hard time with this. Pitchers never regain their pitch once they've lost it. You have to pull the pitcher. I don't get it. Anyway, Oregon's pitching sucks, and Jace, Stovall's performance accepted. It's just a matter of like, well, we'll just keep rotating through these, these pitchers. And it's not like Oregon State is a great batting team, either. They're like a 259 average team, cumulatively. Like, they They have multiple like clunker performances offensively. They lost their first game of the season to New Mexico, putting up like two runs. And you know, you run through their season, you know, like Cal Poly, they lose a game, you know, putting up two runs. You know, they lose to Washington State twice, you know, three runs and one run. They lose to Nevada, putting up one run. Like they lose to Cal, putting up one run. They lose to Washington, putting up two runs. They lost to Oregon, getting shut out. Like Oregon State, you know, is not a great hitting team. And so in the second game, when they get a three-run home run, you know, I'm not real wild about that, but, you know, kind of whatever. But then in the third game to give up 12 runs, like, that's because Oregon's pitching is terrible, you know. And it's not like they're giving up 12 runs to a team that's as good of a batting performance as Oregon. You know, they're giving up 12 runs to a pretty mediocre batting team. And it's, you know, so, like, so, you know, that's the context. You're just like, you just sort of have to understand that Oregon's pitching sucks, and you're going to have to like out bat every team that you play. Mm-hmm. And but like, I sort of like, I know that going into it. And that's the thing that's sort of like, okay, so the game one is like thrilling because it's this really tight, low scoring game. But like, I don't want to see like, it's not that I don't want to see tight, low scoring games because it was fun, but like, there's this pit in the bottom of my stomach going like, Oregon can't hang in tight, low scoring games because their pitching's not good enough. Like, if something's wrong with their bats, Oregon's going to lose. And sure enough, Oregon lost. You know, they lost the series because the bats didn't show up in games one or games two or games three. And like, okay, so now they played midweek games against San Francisco, and what happens? They crushed San Francisco. So, like, okay, great. So what does that mean? Does that mean that, like, Oregon's really great at clobbering, you know, bad teams, but, like, when they face a team that's got a pitcher, the bats go ice cold, you know? So what am I supposed to think about this team, Adam? Like, is there batting an illusion? And if it's an illusion, did that just mean that this team is just sucks top to bottom? Like, no. That's why I'm like, that's why my takeaway from this series was like, oh my God, this really sucked and I hated it. You know, that was what my feeling was. And so that's what my question to you is does this team just suck? Like,
no, I hear you on that. And I agree. Oregon is winning because of their offense. They're a batting team.
But is it an illusion?
I don't think so because it's been too consistent this season so far. You've seen them be able to go. If you see a team be able to go out and do it on a more consistent basis, then you start to figure out, yeah, that's really something like a, you know, an area in which this team can excel. If you just seen it on a few occasions where it was like, hey, they just showed up against a really good team, put up a bunch of runs, bats were on fire, you know, but then they kind of fell back into the pattern of not having a great offense, then sure, I could be like, yeah, it's just an illusion. You know, they show up for certain games, they don't show up for certain games. But the consistency with which they're putting up these runs in these games tells me that it's not an illusion. I do agree with your take that the pitching is terrible. And I think that's why I said I was a little bit encouraged by the two defensive battles, because of the fact that like they were able to hang in there in those kind of games where it was a game where they weren't firing all cylinders. They weren't getting hits. They weren't, you know, putting up runs, but they were still able to hang in those games. Granted, like you said, the Sunday game was a joke. You know, it was terrible. But the other two, I was encouraged to see that even when their bats aren't on fire, that they could hang with Oregon State through, you know, what pitching they have, even if it's not great pitching, if that makes sense.
I mean, like, I think it's a well-coached team. Like, it's not like they, like, fell apart and started crying in the dugout or anything. That's not what I'm questioning. I'm just questioning whether or not, you know, you said you didn't think that the batting was an illusion because you thought that they were, because you thought it was consistent and that it was showing up in multiple games. And I'm sitting here thinking, like, did it? You know, because, like, okay, the batting showed up against Xavier, you know, Is that your good team? Like, okay, the batting didn't really show up against Santa Barbara. They got swept by Santa Barbara. The batting didn't really show up against San Diego. There's only one game that they got more than six runs against San Diego, even though they swept that team. Okay, UCLA, you know, they lost that series, you know, 1-2, but they put up six runs in game one. They put up in a win and seven runs in a loss, 7-8. That was actually a thriller of a game. You know, that was a game where Oregon lost that second game, but I actually was, you know, fine with it. But then they got shut out in game three. Actually, that UCLA series was kind of similar to this Oregon State series. 0-16 in the Sunday game, like, ouch, you know? So, like, okay, against number 13 UCLA, they get six runs and they get seven runs. Like, and then they lose to Niagara. They go up to Pullman and they lose the first game, putting up one run. But then they get 14 runs and 13 runs. Okay, against Washington State. Like, is Washington State a good team? And then they put up a whole bunch of runs against Northwestern State. Like, okay. Is Northwestern State a good team? And they put a bunch of runs against Arizona, which is maybe the worst pitching team in the country. Like, and they put a bunch of runs against Portland. Like, okay. And they don't put up any runs against Oregon State, you know, at all, which, you know, my gut, you know, heart is in my stomach. And they put up a bunch of runs against San Francisco. Is San Francisco a good team? You know, like, yeah, okay. In a bunch of games against arguably a bunch of bad teams, you know, they put up a bunch of runs. Like, is that actually consistent pitching or batting performance? Or is it the case that in, like, maybe three games against good teams, they put up several runs and that actually doesn't qualify as consistent batting performance? And that when they actually, you know, the chips are down and knowing that you have a bad bullpen and you actually need to bat your way out of games, that, you know, that they've only ever really done it like maybe once, and that was against UCLA in game one and really at no other point. And if that's the case, then this team is just like, boy, they're gonna get killed by Stanford in the next series. Like, that's what I'm worried about, man. Like,
yeah,
I don't know. This just sure hasn't been a fun podcast out of me so far.
No,
we're not going to know this until they play Stanford, but, like, what I'm really worried about is this team is, like, just a complete and utter illusion. Like,
yeah, it's tough to tell altogether. I think the reason why I'm kind of, like, looking at the glass half full is just because, you know, instead of looking further back into their season, which, you know, when you and I were talking about them back then, it was more kind of like, okay, what's up with baseball? Are they really everything they're chalked up to be? Is this really even a team that can compete in the conference? Yada, yada, yada. And then I see that 11-game winning streak, okay? And so that's, you know, regardless of whether it's against all great competition or all mediocre competition, 11 games in baseball is something to look at and be like, that's legit. And so it was kind of like during that winning streak that I said that they were showing the consistency of batting, because during 7 of those 11 games during the winning streak, they put up double digits in scoring. And then the eighth time against Portland, it was 9 runs. So that was kind of, you know, the point I was trying to make. Granted, you know, you stepped in with the, okay, but are these really against great squads? Is it really? However, it is a season, and not everybody you're going to face is going to be super top tier. You are going to face some stinkers. You are going to face some mediocre teams. But the fact that Oregon was for that winning streak consistently putting up those kind of runs against opponents showed that, like, yeah, they can consistently get these kind of hits. It wasn't like you were just seeing it in like one or two games where they just suddenly erupted. It was like, okay, yeah, you're consistently seeing them put up double digits in runs throughout an 11-game winning streak, regardless of the opponent. And so that's kind of the point I was trying to make. Now, to your point, is that going to carry over against top-tier competition? At least from what I've seen, it doesn't look like it so far. I would be very surprised if their offense was able to produce much against Stanford, to be honest. I'm not expecting a whole lot. But I think, like I said, it's just the reason for encouragement is because of the fact that, like, you are able to string together a win streak and you are able to show that you can bat your way out of games regardless of whether that's a top tier opponent or not. So I think that's why it's encouraging to see that they're figuring out how to at least win, how to be a winning team, but clearly they have not ascended into the, you know, upper echelon of teams. And yeah. I'm with you on that 100%.
I mean, the thing that was like, the thing that's really cool, you know, about the team was that, like, for the first time, like, in forever, you know, Oregon's baseball had much higher RPI than Oregon State did. And yet, you know, you turned on that series and Oregon State just looked like the better baseball team.
Oh, yeah.
Like, you know, to the point where, you know, everybody's like, well, you know, they hung tough with the real great Beavers. And it's just like, Beavers were not a real great baseball team. You know, Oregon was supposed to be the better team, you know, yeah. In the game. And it's sort of like, sort of made me confirm, you know, sort of like, you know, I'm not really sure that Oregon was the better team, you know. And then, you know, Stanford and frankly, Oregon's RPI is better than Stanford's, you know, mm-hmm. Like, I don't know if that really means anything at this point. Like,
sometimes you got to throw that out the window.
Yeah, I don't know, man. Like, you know, we'll know more when the season goes on. And the other thing is, you know, the series is in Eugene. Oregon's record in Eugene is much worse than it is on the road.
Like, probably because we don't have good baseball weather here.
Yeah, that could be. At any rate, Stanford comes to visit Eugene in PK Park April 14th, 15th, 16th. First games on Friday at 5 o'clock. We'll be covering it this weekend, we'll see what the baseball scorekeeper says about the weather. All right, let's take a break. We come back, we'll talk a little softball.
Hey, it's Kaylee Cuoco for Priceline. Ready to go to your happy place for a happy price? Well, why didn't you say so? Just download the Priceline app right now and save up to 60% on hotels. So whether it's Cousin Kevin's Kazoo Concert in Kansas City, go Kevin! Or Becky's Bachelorette Bash in Bermuda, you never have to miss a trip ever again. So download the Priceline app today. Your savings are waiting.
Go to your happy place for a happy price. Go to your happy price, Priceline.
Well, softball basically had an open week in their conference schedule, and so they looked around the country and tried to find somebody who also did, and they came up with Montana, the Grizz, Lindenwood, they clobbered all of them, three straight run rule performances. Almost three shutouts. They just barely missed getting the shutout against Montana. Interestingly, it did so much damage to their RPI. They actually fell in the polls despite run ruling all three of those opponents. I don't know. There's not a whole lot to say here. You know, they're just sort of clearly overmatched performances. You know, it is, I did like seeing, you know, the pitching performances, cause I've been, you know, a little bit worried about, you know, Oregon's bullpen. Stevie Hansen, started two of those three games. The one against Montana and the second one against Lindenwood. And, you know, she had a pretty excellent performance against both of those teams. And just otherwise, like, the bats were just on fire. Like, you know, just, you know, nobody could stop. Did you learn anything from these series, you know, at all?
Not a whole lot. They were, you know, like I said, they were really just kind of against, you know, opponents that they needed to bring in because they needed somebody to play, and they destroyed them. And, you know, that's that. When I look at softball, the biggest question I have moving into the home stretch of the season here pertains to their conference play and kind of like where this team really is at, because it's very interesting to kind of look at their, you know, conference record and then their overall record, and you're like, okay, wait a minute, how can you have, you know, like a 25-11 overall record, but then be under 500 in conference? But then you tell yourself, hey, but, you know, the Pac-12 is loaded with some of the better softball.
Well, and it's because the first three series.
Yeah, yeah. And so the first three
top 10 teams. Yeah, they had the. Yeah, yeah. So, going. Yeah, when they finished it up, they had the number one, you know, they had the number one RPI in the country, even though they had three conference loss, lost conference series. You know, simply because, like, I mean, it was just ridiculous, the schedule that they played.
Yeah, it was crazy. And so in that sense, you're kind of like, all right, they have that conference record because they played, you know, these juggernaut squads all in a row, And so I think it'll be very interesting to see how they do in this last, you know, stretch run of the season against their conference opponents. Now that you're finally getting some conference play that's not against these teams pretty much competing for a national championship. So the question is, are we going to see Oregon finish the season on you know, a nice good run where it's like, yeah, we can hang with these Pac-12 teams as long as they're not, you know, like top 10? Or are we going to see a little more kind of like, oh, okay, they were really just kind of like mediocre within the conference? So that's what kind of intrigues me. You know, obviously over the course of the season, it looked like Stevie Hansen was invincible, and then it was like, okay, she's invincible after all. But still, I liked what I saw from them in the fact that, you know, like, even though they had these really tough matchups against these top 10 teams and stuff, like, they weren't getting swept in the series, and they weren't losing uncompetitive games where they had to call it because the other team was just obliterating them.
Yeah, exactly.
They were staying in them and even, like, eking out a win in some of them. So
not some of them, all of them. Every one of the series was, you know, it was a 1-2 loss, and you know, they never got run ruled, and every one of them, you know, it was like, you know, they were competitive games. Like, you know, the biggest, you know, margin of loss in any of them was, you know, they lost by 5 at Washington, and even that one, it was the bottom of the 7th when they gave, you know, like the game kind of got broken open. Even that one's, it's sort of a misleading score. That was a very tight game until very late. Like, you know, all of these games were super, super competitive games. Like, you know, they did not get, like, out-competed in any of these games in any, you know, way, shape, or form. I don't really worry about that at all. Like, I think Oregon is right there with, I don't think that Oregon is a top 10 team. I think they're a notch below the top 10 teams, but I think they're right there with them. You know, like, I think Oregon's probably like a top 15 team. You know, they're just like, they're right, you know, they're just like right there. They're, you know, close enough to be competitive with them, like to grab a game in a 3-game series with them, you know, to make them sweat, but like, they're still going to lose the series because they don't have, I don't think that they have top to bottom elite bullpen. Like, I don't think they have 1-2-3 elite aces. And I don't think they have, I think they have very, very good batting, but I don't think they have just like amazing get you out of anything batting, the way that like Washington does, which is just like, oh my god, Washington's batting is just incredible. Which, like, is fine. Oregon's a pretty well-rounded team. Like, they have good pitching, they have good batting, they field well, they base run well. They're actually, you know, it's a really smart team. Like, it's a, you know, it's a really heady team. It's a very well-rounded team. It's just that, like, you know, every team that they, all the elite teams that they play, like, there's, it's like they're also, you know, that, but they're elite in something. And it's like, well, that's why they're a top 10 team, you know? It's one of the reasons why I'm sort of like, I'm still sort of like cool with Melissa Lombardi. Like, I know a lot of people are sort of like, you know, are sort of like, fire her. She's had like five, you know, I'm just like, nah, at least for the, like, for what Rob Mullins is willing to invest in the softball program, which, like, you know, if you want to argue about something, you can argue about that, but you're probably not, you know, like, unless an Oregon fan, you know, scratches a lotto ticket or invents some way of turning grass seed into rocket fuel and becomes a billionaire, and wants to put $1 billion into the Oregon softball program, like, for the amount of money the Oregon is willing to invest into the softball program, like, I think that this sort of, like, incremental, you know, year over year improvement, where, like, what did we talk about all of last year, was that they needed to get a second, you know, decent pitcher, you know, yes, into the bullpen. Well, they did. Okay. Yep. So, like, you know, well, you know, what are we going to be talking about next year? They need to get a third one, you know, and they need to, like, up the, you know, the batting average by about, you know, half a point. Well, that's probably what they're going to do. You know, like, is that, you know, like, yeah, okay, you know, incremental improvement. Like, it's,
yeah, I'm like I said, I'm not frustrated with the rate at which they've been improving. I didn't think it was going to be a quick fix. I liked the hiring of Lombardi when it happened, but I also noted that she was literally stepping into a completely gutted program.
Well, yeah.
As in, like, Halloween pumpkin carved out. And so I was like, yeah, this is not going to be something where you're just walking on in there and then flip the switch and Oregon softball is back to what it was right before she came. No, I wasn't expecting that at all. That's why I think, like, this stretch run of the season will be telling as to kind of, like, the improvements that she's been able to make. Because, like I said, you know, our performances against top tier competition were not bad, and our performances against everybody else have been pretty good.
That'll be telling
as to whether, you know, during the summer doldrums again, if we're going to be sitting there talking about should she be on the hot seat or not. I think if they have a strong finish to the season, finish with a nice winning record in the Pac-12 and considering all the competition they had to go through, no, I don't think she should be on the hot seat. I think that would be enough to be like, okay, she built this from the ground up and we're back to a competitive team in the conference.
Well,
not necessarily a dominant team in the conference, but a competitive team in the conference, which in the Pac-12 is saying something.
You know, and given that they've gotten the top 10 teams out of the way, like, you know, it remains to be seen how the rest of the conference play goes. But, like, I don't see top 10 teams on the schedule. And they get the Pac-12, you know, for the first time, the softball side gets a Pac-12 tournament. So, like, they'll probably get another bite at the apple at some of those, you know, Stanford and UCLA at Washington. You know, they'll probably play at least one of those teams again in the Pac-12 tournament. Just, you know, law of probabilities, they'll probably see one of them again. So, like, hey, maybe they learn something, you know, and probably get a, you know, shot of revenge. So, like, we'll see how that goes. They get Arizona State next. That's a series that's coming up, going down to Tempe for that. Arizona State is sort of like the inverse of Oregon. Like, that's a team that has lost, you know, in run rule fashion, to some conference teams. You know, they lost their series to Arizona, including getting run ruled, 0-11. To Arizona. They lost their series to Cal. They bizarrely beat Washington. although of course they beat Washington in Tempe, which, like, of course that happened, right? Like, Washington just can't win in Tempe. I can't imagine why that should be.
Might have something to do with 100-degree weather or something.
Yeah, right. They lost their series to Utah, you know, like, they, you know, Arizona State softball does not look like a top 10 team. No. So, like, you know, I beyond that, you know, I don't know a whole lot about, you know, Arizona State softball. You know, sorry, folks, I've been doing football film study. Yeah. a little distracted. But, you know, this does not look like a top 10 team. So, you know, I'm not out here making predictions, but I am sort of making if then statements. And my if then statement is that, like, yeah, if Oregon softball wants to say that it's a top 15 team, and that it's going to run through the rest of its, you know, conference schedule and demonstrate that, like, yeah, no, like, we're, you know, we're right there. That, like, you know, first step is obliterating, you know, what looks like a fairly vulnerable Arizona State team in their home stadium, which is the project of this weekend starting April 14th, 6 p.m. In Tempe, Arizona.
Yeah.
All right, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll talk some of the football transfers, the defensive backs who come in.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
All right, so I am wrapping up my transfer series. The last two guys to come in, or at least for now, the defensive backs, Tysheem Johnson, who came in from Ole Miss, and Evan Williams, who came in from Fresno State. I'll start with Tysheem Johnson. He was a 2021 recruit, as a four-star. He played for the 2 years that head coach Lane Kiffin employed DJ Durkin, of all people, and a guy named Chris Partridge, who was like the Michigan linebackers coach, and then, like, at the end of 2022 went back to Michigan to be the linebackers coach. It's really weird. DJ Durkin became the Texas A&M defensive coordinator because apparently, like, Jimbo Fisher is trying to assemble, like, the coaching staff of, like, all the coaches that everybody hates. Like, he's got, like, Bobby Petrino and DJ Durkin on his staff. I don't know, man. Like, so anyway, here's the crazy thing about the Ole Miss defense that Tysheem Johnson played in for the 2 years that I watched him in, because he was like he was a true freshman in 2021, but he basically played in every single game. He was like pretty high in the rotation. He was a backup, but he was like the second stringer, so he was like he was in pretty frequently.
Yeah.
So, like, ton of film. I had a ton of film on him. And then he was the starter in 2022, and he was in, you know, on you know, almost every snap. So I had a ton of film on him. Here's the crazy thing about the defense that Durkin and Partridge ran at Ole Miss. It was a dime defense on every single snap. And when I say every single snap, I am not exaggerating. That is not hyperbole. Every single snap. It didn't matter what opponent they were playing. It didn't matter what personnel the offense was in. They could be in an empty set. They could be in 11 personnel, 12 personnel. They could be in 14 personnel. They could be in the I formation with, you know, 10 offensive linemen. Ole Miss would be in, have their, you know, three defensive linemen, two linebackers, and six defensive backs. Like, yep. It was, you know, down distance didn't matter. Field position didn't matter. Goal line, third and inches on the goal line. Guess what defensive, you know, yeah, package Ole Miss was in? Dying package.
Not really willing to adjust according to circumstances. Yeah. Of
I mean, it didn't matter. They were in a dime package every single down. And like, I guess I understand, I definitely understand why Lane Kiffin was into it, because here's the deal. Every defense, or almost every decent defense in America, has a dime package, like as a situational defensive package, because it's what you trot out on like third and long, you know, yeah. Or like, you know, when your opponent's in desperation mode because they're down by like two scores with like 4 minutes left and you know they got to throw the ball deep on every play.
It's a no, you have to pass.
Yeah. Not just pass, but pass deep, you know.
Pass deep. Yeah. You're covering the deep slots. You're giving up the short ball on purpose.
Right. Not just, or the run. And here's the other thing about the SEC for any you know, Pac-12 fans who are listening who may have some illusions about the SEC as being like, oh, it's man ball, you know, like because like that's the fiction that SEC fans for a long time like to tell everybody about themselves. Not really true. You know, the SEC in the last 5 years or so has definitely, most of those teams have like switched over to be running like very Big 12 reminiscent, you know, type of, you know, very pass heavy, you know, offenses. You know, frankly, I sort of got it, you know, like I understood why they were like, well, let's put out a pass, you know, a stop the pass type of defense against a league that's going to a very pass heavy, you know, set of offenses. OK, I understand that. And the other thing is, I definitely understood why Lane Kiffin would be into it, because like Lane Kiffin would believe that his offense was going to put. It was going to score 50 points every game and therefore put every opponent into desperation mode. And the crazy thing about 2022 was that he was right about, you know, in the first seven games, he was scoring 41 points a game.
Yeah.
And like, and that average, it's not like it's skewed by like two games in which he scores 80 points. I mean, like every single game, it's like right dead on at like 41. It's like, you know, 43, 39, you know, like he's hitting like, it's basically like seven, you know, six touchdowns almost exactly on the dime, you know, every single game. And so like, he's right, you know, and so therefore it was really, you know, it was kind of fun to watch that dime defense play against a bunch of pass happy offenses who were, you know, in desperation mode because they were feasting. And so Tysheem Johnson got to do his thing, man. But then
they actually played some good, decent competition.
Then they started, two things happened sort of simultaneously, and I think it's a coincidence that they happened simultaneously. One of them is something goes terribly wrong with Ole Miss's offense, and I don't really know what that was because I wasn't watching the offensive side of the ball because like I only had a week to do this project. I'm not watching the offense to solve that question, but something goes wrong with their offense, and they go from scoring 41 points a game in the first 7 weeks to scoring 23 points a game in the last six games. So all of a sudden the offenses aren't in desperation mode anymore. And then the other thing that happens is they just start playing teams that are really comfortable running the ball. Like they start playing the SEC teams that are actually like the old school kind of SEC teams, like Arkansas and LSU and, like Auburn should have beat them. They didn't because their quarterbacks kept fumbling the ball, including Robbie Ashford, you know, blast from the past. But anyway, like just crazy, just like dropping the ball in the backfield. It was nuts. Like Auburn totally should have beat Ole Miss because they were running the ball down their throat. Because of course the dime defense can't stop the run. And this is where it goes back to Tysheem Johnson and why, you know, read my article. It's interesting because I sort of feel like conflicted about writing it. And here's sort of, you know, why I felt conflicted about it is that, and because like I wind up leaving a bunch of tape on the cutting room floor. And the reason for that is I want, part of the film, like the good part that like the salad days at the beginning of the season, I felt like was unfair to include much of that because it's like because that's non-representative. You have like the perfect defense to go up against these things. And so like, that's too good. And then in the bad part of the season where the opposing offenses are just running straight at him and you have 5'10" Tysheem Johnson being asked to play like a linebacker role. I mean, that's the thing that's gross about this defense. And I hated watching it. If everybody listened to last week's podcast and I was like, spoiler alert, I hate Ole Miss's defense. This is what I'm talking about. This is what I was talking about last week. I hated watching all these opposing offenses just marching down the field and running the ball at poor Tysheem Johnson. I was like, my heart was going out to this kid who is like, he knows his assignment. He knows exactly what he's supposed to do. He diagnoses the play perfectly. He, you know, gets himself into position. He is, you know, making a beeline for the play, and he is doing what in any other defense a linebacker is supposed to be doing. A dude who is 3 inches taller and 30 pounds heavier, or more ideally 5 inches taller and 50 pounds heavier, and smashing that back and stopping him dead. But because he's 5'10 and 195 pounds, the back drags him for 7 yards. And I'm like, well, I'm sorry, Tysheem. I've got to, you know, mark that one down as a frowny face on my tally sheet because you got dragged 7 yards. But it's also kind of unfair to you to, you know what I mean? Like,
yeah, you were put in a no-win situation.
Yeah, exactly. And so I'm like, so this stuff is unfair too. So it's like, okay, so it's unfair for me to put in the good stuff because, you know, your defense is unfairly, you know, good against this situation. And it's unfair for me to put in the bad stuff because it's unfairly bad against this situation, you know? So it was like a real struggle for me to figure out what film clips to put in to, you know, article. This is me on the podcast complaining about having to write my article. I ultimately did write my article. It was, I guess what I'm saying is, it was a struggle to find clips that I felt were both representative, you know, that fairly represented, you know, an accurate, like, slice of what I saw, you know, like, that weren't cherry-picked, that weren't like, oh, I only saw this once, but it shows this kid off, it makes him look really good or really bad or whatever, you know, like, no, it's representative because I'm dedicated to doing that in every film clip that I ever select that shows up in any article that I write is going to be representative. But at the same time, is like fair to him, you know, that isn't like, you know, this is, you know, he was put in a bad situation and this is, you know, making him look bad for reasons that are outside of his control, or at least without an explanation, you know, for why that is. So like, that was a real struggle. And I guess like, this was my opportunity on this podcast to explain how I struggled with it and how I like worked through what clips I wound up selecting. But you know, at the end of the day, you know, what I came away with Tysheem Johnson is I expect that he's going to wind up playing the nickel position for Oregon. I think he's going to be really good at it because he's a really twitchy athlete. Like, he's really like, his short area burst is really good. Like, he reacts to plays really intelligently. Like, I really think his football IQ is very high. He diagnoses plays very well. And if you just don't put him in a position and that where you ask him to be a linebacker when he's not built like to be a linebacker, then, yeah, you know, he's great. So great, you know. Yeah. And I think
a productive player when he's put in a position that he can succeed rather than a position where there's just no option for that.
And the other thing that's useful to know, and this will be useful when I talk about Evan Williams here in a moment, is that his film is split about 45-55 between playing up high, like, you know, dropping back as part of, because Ole Miss primarily played a two high zone, where he'd be one of the two high safeties who are dropping back deep. And then when I say deep, I mean fairly deep, like about 30 yards deep. But then they sort of buzz him down a lot. And then the 55 would be like, he'd be playing sort of more like a nickel. And then it's just that, you know, Ole Miss's dime defense is a two nickel defense, which, like, that's where the dime gets its name, right? Two nickels is a dime.
Yeah. basic math.
Yeah, right. Because we don't have a 6 cent piece here in the United States. They do have that in other countries, but not here in the U.S. Anyway,
which but pertains to American football.
Yeah, precisely. The correct form. So like much of his film is playing like a nickel defender. It's just that he's often sort of asked to play something that in any other defensive system would be like an outside linebacker or an overhang backer. And like he's just not built as an OLB or as an overhang ILB or like a strong side backer. And so when he is in that position and he goes to make that tackle, it's like he doesn't stop the guy dead, or like to the extent that he is, it's as part of a gang tackle and it looks like a swarm of ants jumping on a spider. Like if anybody's old enough to play the like Sim Ant, like that's what it looks like. the number of like solo tackles that I have him making is where he just stops the dude dead. It's not a ton of film on that. But I don't think that's the role that Oregon's going to ask him to play. However, he does have a lot of experience and good experience playing as like a high safety. So even though I think that Oregon's going to use him as a nickel, I think that he's versatile enough and certainly experienced enough to like flip it around and play high safety too. You know what? You know, I'm not sure how Oregon's going to want to configure that. Maybe on the strong side, or maybe to the passing strength. You know, or maybe. Well, no, they'll probably have Addison to the field. Well, we'll see. I don't know if they're going to want to organize it on field boundary or weak side, strong side. Probably they'll keep him on the strong side. I think that probably makes the most sense. But anyway, I think they could flip him around. And so that takes me to Evan Williams. Evan Williams played for Fresno State for 4 years. He came in as a 2019 recruit. He started as a backup, but by the back half of the 2019 season, he had taken over as a starter. You couldn't keep him off the field. He's really good. Fresno State only played 6 games in the 2020 season. He played the first 4 of them, but then they held him out the last 2 and they wouldn't tell anybody why. I think you can probably guess. And then 2021, he was a full-time starter. He played every single game. Fresno State went 10-3 in that season. They just barely missed making the conference championship. They probably should have, but there was a weird game that happened in that season. And then in 2022, Fresno State did win the conference championship, and then they did beat Washington State in the bowl game. Amusingly enough, because Fresno State Oregon opened their season with Fresno State in 2021, and then Fresno State winds up playing Pac-12 teams all the time, including 2 different wins and 3 different one score losses over the last 4 years. They beat UCLA in 2021. They beat Wazoo in the bowl game. They had a 1-score loss against Oregon State. They had a 1-score loss against Oregon in that opener, and they had a 1-score loss against USC in 2019. So the only time they've lost by more than 1 score was against USC in 2021. In that game, they killed them.
This is not new for Fresno State either. They've often been a tough opponent.
Yeah, I know. It's a
12 teams.
Yeah, right. No, it was the 2022 game. The USC killed him. But that was the game that Evan Williams got hurt. Yeah. So here's the other thing about Evan Williams is that that was their week 3 game. Was against USC. He actually was playing really well. I took a bunch of clips from that USC game because he was covering Jordan Addison really well. He has this beautiful breakup against one of their tight ends that I included in my article. Like, he's played really well against USC, but then he gets hurt. He injured something in his knee, like his ligament damage apparently, but we never get anything more than that. And he misses like 5 weeks. Well, one of them was a bye. He misses 4 games and a bye week. And then he comes back against San Diego State, and he's got this big brace on his knee. And he looks like a slightly slower. I hate to admit. I think maybe he could have used another week off, but the week after that, he looks back up to full speed and he plays the rest of the season and he looks great. And he goes on to, like, they win the conference championship. It's the first team in FBS history that starts their season 1-4 and then goes on to, finish whatever it is they, I think they finished like 11-4. I was just like they won every one of their remaining games, including the conference championship, and they beat Wazoo in the bowl game. That was cool. Evan Williams is great. Like, he's really great. Here's the thing about, and in many ways, he's great in exactly the ways that Tysham Johnson is. And like all the things that I said that was great about Tysham Johnson are great about Evan Williams. But here's the thing that's interesting about Evan Williams. He's a little bit bigger. He's like 6 foot or 6'1". Mm-hmm. Like a little bit bigger, and he's a little older, right? Like he's, you know, like I said, 2019 recruit, not 2021 recruit.
Yeah.
And, so it's interesting. I don't want to say they're quite interchangeable, but the way that I expect them to be used is I think that Tysham Johnson is going to play the nickel position, and I think that Williams is going to play the high safety, probably on the strong side position, but I think they could be flipped, and I actually would be surprised if Oregon's coaching staff doesn't like flip them on quite a few downs, because you can definitely use Evan Williams in the box. Fresno did a lot. And for that whole long rant that I went on about how, like, I was really pissed off at Ole Miss for using Tysham Johnson in the box too much and like asking him to do stuff that his frame's not built for, Evan Williams has a few plays in the box, and I put him in my article where it was like, damn, he stopped that running back dead. You know, like, he's
so kind of like Evan Williams wasn't in the box enough.
Well, no, he was in the box an appropriate amount. Like, he's still not a linebacker, but like, it's more because, like, I don't want to see him taking on like offensive linemen. Like, that's still a losing proposition. No, he's not that big, but he's safety. That's like, he diagnoses the play, knifes in between the blockers and hits that running back and stops him. And like, I've got a bunch of clips, man. Like, you're going to enjoy watching the videos in my article of him hitting dudes. Like, him hitting dudes is pretty much the entirety of the 16 clips in my article about Evan Williams, and they're all fun. And actually, a couple of them are Oregon, so maybe those two won't be fun.
That'll be it. Like,
but they're all him hitting dudes. So, like, even though I suspect that, you know, Johnson's going to be the nickel and Williams is going to be the strong safety, I also suspect that they're going to flip that around sometimes and have Williams play down lower and ask him to hit some dudes, because it's fun to watch him hit dudes, and he does it pretty well. And when Ole Miss asked Johnson to hit dudes, it was just sort of like, that's a 5'10 dude. Like, don't ask him to do, ask him to hit wide receivers, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
You know, ask him to take down gazelles, because he's a cheetah, you know?
Not SEC running backs.
Yeah. So, like, yeah, man, I guess what I'm saying is it was a treat to watch both of these guys film, knowing that they're transferring to Oregon, because they're both super versatile, and Oregon needs versatility. And for anybody who's thinking like, oh, we have these guys who are locked into their roles and we know exactly what they're going to do, my message to you is like, I actually think that there's so much versatility in these guys, and that they're sort of also kind of like playing a bit against body type, that like you could actually see them sort of playing different spots on the field at different points in the game, which I think is cool. Like, I think that gives the defensive staff some tools to work with, which is really fun. So yeah, read my article. It'll be going up about the same time that this podcast goes up, and you should enjoy the film clips in it. There are certainly a lot of fireworks.
Yeah, should be good stuff. Oregon needs all the depth they can get at the DB, for sure.
Yeah, definitely.
Not going to be able to replace a Christian Gonzalez, but you can at least bring in enough guys to try and, you know,
yeah, well,
get the job.
I mean, the cornerback position is a sort of a completely different ball of wax. You know, these guys aren't corners. I mean, but the other interesting thing is how this interacts with, you know, they brought in Justin Jacobs and Connor Saleh to be inside linebackers. Those guys weren't playing inside linebackers at their previous schools, Iowa and Arizona State. You know, they were playing more, you know, strong side backers who play outside of the box. So it's like everybody that they brought in, you know, all of these defensive guys, well, except for Jordan Birch, who's, you know, he's an edge guy. All their defensive transfers that they brought in. Well, they also brought in a cornerback, but I didn't get enough film to do anything with Jackson from Alabama because he's a backup cornerback, and you never get enough film on them. So we'll just see how he works out on the spring game on the 29th. But like, you know, all their defensive transfers, you know, Justin Jacobs, Connor Saleh, you know, Tysheem Johnson, Evan Williams, they're all potential candidates to play the star safety position.
Yeah.
Like you could at some point or another move those guys into playing that position. Like, and the running theme for all four of those guys, even though I don't think all four of those guys are going to be playing the star safety position, is that they could. And I think that there's a reason for that, and that's that Dan Lanning is prioritizing pass coverage.
Yeah.
And I think that's because he, as maybe, you know, I don't think it's a coincidence, he's a younger guy and he's an analytically driven guy. And what he sort of realized is that in modern college football, you have to stop the pass. The pass is the thing that kills you, and that everybody that he's brought in are pass stoppers. Like that's their prime, you know, like, so like, you know, watch my article, or, you know, watch the film clips of my article about Jacobs and Saleh and Williams, yeah, and Johnson. And what you'll see is that the premium for these guys is coverage skills and, you know, and stopping, you know, and stopping guys in space, you know, yeah, and the sort of like old school neck roll guys, the thumpers, you know, the guys who can turn the 5 yards in a cloud of dust into 3 yards in a cloud of dust. That's not been the priority, you know,
no, especially not in the Pac-12, which is, yeah, loaded with some of the best quarterbacks in the country. You're going to need that, yeah, that coverage.
All right. I think it's going to do it for us this week. We'll wrap it up there. You got any parting words and wisdom for us, Adam?
It's spring, and we got plenty of football going on, baseball and softball. Be happy, people. It's a fun time. The summer is not going to yield a whole lot to talk about, so soak it in.
well, the baseball hosting Stanford. We'll see how the weather goes. The softball is heading down to Tempe. Should be a lot of sunshine down there, but it never rains on this podcast.